I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. When you look at the history of science, it makes a lot more sense looking backwards than it does looking forward. When we peer over our shoulder, each decision, each discovery in the past seems to lead logically and inevitably to the next. But when you're in the midst of a search, you're constantly tripping on false assumptions or picking up after false starts. Consider in the field of astronomy the hunt for the stellar parallax. Now, if you, like me, don't know what that is, you will by the end of this hour. The stellar parallax turned out to be the key in solving a very old scientific challenge, one first posed by the Greeks: how to measure the distance from the Earth to a star. Like most scientific challenges at the time, it must have seemed an impossibly ambitious, even arrogant goal. Now, it's old hat. We have new challenges. As we speak, a NASA satellite is speeding out past the sun to try to record the afterglow of the original Big Bang. But to know where we're going, we need to know how we got here. And that's where we'll start. Connection listeners, when you look out at the cosmos, what is the scientific question you'd like answered? The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can join us online at theconnection.org. Joining me in the studio now is Alan Hirschfeld. He's author of Parallax, The Race to Measure the Cosmos. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dick. It's a pleasure to be on The Connection.
When we talk about measuring the cosmos, can we simplify this down to figuring out the distance from the Earth to a star?
Well, that's where it all begins. But, of course, there is much cosmos beyond just the nearest stars. There are galaxies upon galaxies upon galaxies outside our very own. So the history that I chronicle in my book has to do with the attempt to measure that very first distance to a star.
And before we go much further, I'm going to put you to work as a teacher and see if you can give me an explanation of what parallax is, because that's pretty key to understanding how this adventure story you trace through the years works.
That's right. It's a technical sounding term, but it's a very everyday kind of phenomenon. And let me preface that just by saying that it was the hope of astronomers for many centuries to just judge the relative distances of stars by how bright they looked in the sky, figuring that the brightest-looking ones were the nearest and the dimmest-looking ones were the farthest. But they very quickly came to the realization that stars are a very, very diverse species, and you really cannot judge how far away they are by simply the way they look in the sky. So they needed to come up with a different way of doing it, and that's where the parallax comes in. Now, rather than defining parallax, we can do a nice little self-demonstration.
Perfect.
Here's the teacher in me coming out. You take your index finger and you hold it in front of your face, maybe a foot away or so.
Right.
And you sight your finger. Let's start just with your right eye. Close your left eye.
Okay.
And then blink quickly so that you're looking instead with your left eye and not your right.
And does the finger move in relation to its background? Yes, it does.
It appears to move side to side. That's correct. That's parallax.
So it's the same principle of 3D vision, of learning that if I want to reach for my glass of water, for example, I look through both eyes at the same time. It helps me zero in on exactly how far that glass of water is from me, from my hand.
That's exactly right. It's one of the ways that our eyes and brain together gauge how far nearby objects are. Other ways are experience, for example.
Right.
But if you now take this same experiment, but instead of your finger being a foot away, move it right up near the tip of your nose, or maybe not quite that close, it's hard to see. But if you now repeat the blinking left and right, if you recall how big the side-to-side shift was before, it's bigger now.
The closer the object is to your eyes.
That's right. And if you put your finger as far away as possible from your eyes and you repeat this little blinking experiment, the parallax shift is smaller. So evidently, parallax and distance are linked to one another, and therein lay the hope of ancient astronomers and astronomers through the centuries to try to gauge the distance of a star. They were hoping to see a little side-to-side wobble of the stars as the Earth circled the sun.
And in measuring the distance of the wobble, they could mathematically figure out what the distance would be from the point of observation from the Earth?
That's correct. There's a very simple mathematical relationship that would allow them to figure out how far away that star is.
I said a little while ago that there really is a sort of adventure story nature to the book that you've written. You know, it's part Harrison Ford, it's part... Give me an example of the sort of return that you did to these names that you knew through scholarship, but that you'd never really explored through as people.
I guess in writing this book, I learned how incomplete my scientific education was. As a scientist, you learn about the names and the dates and the discoveries that are associated with those names
right.
and dates. You learn the data, you learn the equations and so on. You learn the techniques. But you are not really taught in any way the people. Who are these people? Who is Galileo? What was he truly like? Or any of the other figures that come into my book. And that was the wonderful discovery that I made in researching this book.
Have you got a favorite, a tale of one person?
Oh,
then?
Yes. It's got to be Joseph Fraunhofer.
Fraunhofer,
a good German name. He lived in the early 1800s, and this is certainly not a name that is known to the general public, of course, although it is a
not
name.
Not yet?
Not yet, that's right. Although he was known in his own day, as you'll soon hear. It is a name that's known to astronomers, though, because of all the work that he did in the field. But here is a life that could have been penned by Dickens. Imagine this boy's life, born in poverty, orphaned by age 11. Both mother and father died. By that time, his mother fell down the basement stairs and broke her neck. He was then shuttled off to for an apprenticeship, or we might call it a six-year prison sentence because
right.
it was just so horrible, with a master glass cutter in Munich. And this glass cutter was supposed to teach him the art of decorative glass cutting, which he did not really do. He had the young Joseph Fraunhofer live in a windowless room, did not allow him even a candle by which to read, and in fact forbade books entirely, and also did not allow Fraunhofer to go to the Sunday apprentices' school, which all the other apprentices were permitted to do. So Fraunhofer was treated more or less as a household slave by this master and his wife. One day, the workshop and residence collapsed, just came down in a pile of rubble suddenly, trapping Fraunhofer, the master, and his wife. It was a big sensation in Munich at the time. Rescuers immediately extricated the master unharmed. The wife was killed. And Fraunhofer was buried in the rubble for some 4 hours, as best my research has determined. When the rescuers finally got down into the rubble, they could hear him calling and eventually did unearth him. And wouldn't you know it, the Prince of Bavaria, the future king, happened to be there on scene when all of this rescue effort was going on. And in this young Fraunhofer, who was 14 years old at the time, he saw a symbol of hope for his people who were suffering from terrible economic hardship. And he, in a sense, adopted Fraunhofer. He did tell Fraunhofer to think of him, the prince, as his father. And needless to say, Fraunhofer was treated much, much better for the duration of his apprenticeship, was given an education, and just to fast forward to the end of this story, became the greatest telescope maker that had ever lived.
That was the key to unlocking the stellar parallax, that the improvements that came over time to the telescope, right?
That's correct. I liken the attempt to measure star distances to the early attempts to climb Mount Everest. In both cases, the goal is evident. You can literally see the peak. You can see the stars. Also, there was a severe underestimation of the difficulty of the task, and the equipment was lousy for a long time.
And the why do you do it in the first place question, is it equally relevant, you know, because it's there?
Well, I've been thinking about that, and I guess that's as good an answer as any. We astronomers, we more or less can't help but explore the universe because it's right there every night. It's impossible to ignore. And we have this natural drive to try to explore it as best we can.
And as we have, we're going to later in the hour discuss the science that's taking us on to further explore it. Does, in your mind, does this have some kind of practical application, or as pure science, is it simply a matter of filling in the blanks so we can make more sense of our own place in the cosmos?
Practical applications of astronomy are admittedly far and few between. And I don't think anyone, any astronomer, can really argue that we should do it because it will, in some obvious way, benefit mankind. There have been offshoots of various astronomical endeavors that help mankind, but basically it's just to enrich our knowledge and, in a sense, to ennoble us. We always have had this desire to learn about the environment in which we live. And now we finally have the ability to really explore the not just the near environment on Earth, but the very farthest reaches of the universe.
So when the first scientist using this latest version telescope finally nailed stellar parallax, just curious, how far away was that star from the Earth? What was the conclusion?
Well, that star, this was done in 1838, just to put a little timeline on that. It was around 10 light years away, 10 to 11 light years. To put that in some earthly perspective, each one of those 10 light years is equivalent to about 6 trillion miles. So it is, even this, one of the very nearest stars, is extremely far away.
This was Hessel who did this?
Bessel,
I'm sorry.
Yes.
So Bessel turns around and says, I got it, it's 10 million? No, how many light years?
It's 10 light years.
10 light years.
Times 6 trillion, so we're talking 60 trillion miles.
I found the star, it's 60 trillion miles away. How was it treated at the time in the 1830s? Was this, finally it's been done, or did it not get that sort of attention?
Well, there was a lot of suspicion of all the claims of star distances by that time, because there had been, you know, literally dozens of astronomers who had claimed success. And it eventually turned out that none of these astronomers had, in fact, measured the distance to a star. They were a victim of their own hopefulness, but their measurements could not be trusted. Bessel's, however, could. So there was a rejoicing in the astronomical community. The vastness of the universe did not surprise anyone at the time, though.
Oh, interesting.
Because by that time, astronomers had realized if the stars were any closer, we would have measured them. We would have measured the distances by now. So it just more or less confirmed what they already knew and made them feel less troubled that finally we had done it.
Alan Hirschfeld is author of Parallax, The Race to Measure the Cosmos. And when we come back after our break, we'll find out where we are in the ongoing race to figure out more about the galaxies around us. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join us with your question about the cosmos, 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. My name is Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. From Baltimore. I'm Dick Gordon. This is the Mapping of the Universe Connection, and this is Cape Canaveral last weekend.
Board 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Main engine start and liftoff of the Delta II rocket with the MAP spacecraft, exploring the past and future of our universe. System has started.
That was the blast off of the microwave and isotropy probe, MAP. Joining us on the line now from Princeton University is Layman Page. Layman is a physics professor and one of the scientists who dreamed up this project, mapping the entire universe in order to capture the afterglow of the Big bang. Did I get that right?
That's great. It's a pleasure to join you.
And thanks for being here on the holiday. This whole thing is based on the theory that the universe was created by one very big bang. Is there much question about that at this point?
I think, you know, among cosmologists, there isn't much question. There's now so much data that it's hard to come up with another model that for which everything can be pieced together. But one of this isn't a bang like a firecracker, say, going off in a room. It's really an explosion of space, if you will. You know, if the universe wasn't finite in the past, then it explodes. Our picture really is that it was always infinite, will always be infinite, but that really space was being made, and it just started to be made at the Big Bang in a serious way.
Do you have any notion of how long ago this Big Bang occurred?
About 15 billion years ago.
15 billion years ago. So now we're sending up a little creature that's supposed to take photographs, stop me if I'm wrong here, of the residual heat left over from that bang, right?
Yes. You wouldn't quite call them photographs. This is the satellite has a number of receivers on it that are like very fancy television receivers. And so it's measuring microwaves, right? That microwaves, it's the near the same wavelength of radiation that you receive on with your TV. In fact, if you take your TV and tune it to an inactive channel and look at the fuzz there, something like 1% of that fuzz comes from this radiation that's left over from the Big Bang. And what this satellite is doing is it's going out to this place a million miles from the Earth and measuring that fuzz, if you will, all over the sky, mapping the whole sky at these microwave frequencies.
Lyman, why do we have to be a million miles away to do it if we can actually see this, you know, on our own television screen?
Well, we're looking for tiny temperature variations in the sky. There's a direct link between the amount of microwave energy that you receive and the temperature of the sky. And we have to get away far away from the Earth because the signatures, the sort of the patterns we're looking for in this ancient light are a few hundred thousandths of a degree centigrade. And as you can imagine, if you can see it on your TV screen, you know, television stations are blasting radiation at us from down here.
Right.
The Earth itself is glowing very brightly. The sun is glowing. The atmosphere glows. Everything around us is glowing, and the radiation from all those objects can confound the measurements that we're trying to make.
I've heard this referred to as taking baby pictures of the universe. Is that a description that you buy into?
Oh, yes, completely. No, this microwave radiation, this is the oldest light in the universe. The photons, right, what light's made of, if you will,
right,
they formed in the first few seconds to minutes of the universe and bounced around off electrons very early on. And then at some point, about 100,000 years after the Big Bang, they scattered. The universe had cooled enough, so they bounced off an electron for the last time. That electron then went to jump onto a proton to form a hydrogen atom. But since that time, this photon, this particle of light, has traversed the universe until it comes and hits our detectors and is gobbled up by them and turned into a temperature signal, if you will. So when we look at this light, and we should say really this radiation, because you can't see it with your eyes, of course, only with your TV. We're looking at a picture, a fossil, of the very earliest universe.
Stay with us on the line, Lyman. I want to bring Alan Hirschfeld, the author of Parallax, back into the conversation, because I get the idea of making a really powerful telescope so I can see a star really clearly, but Lyman's taking me in areas of greater theory. Do you see this as the next logical series of, now he's warned me against using photographs, but understanding of what's out there?
Well, one of the big breakthroughs in terms of observational astronomy was to view the heavens at, well, I was going to use the word wavelengths, but in radiations, in forms of light that we can't see with our eyes, such as radio waves and microwaves, as Lyman was mentioning, infrared and all these other types, because the universe gives off energy of all different sorts. And if you're just going to view it the way that your eye could see it, even with the benefit of a telescope, then you're really restricting your view, and you can't see the entire story in some sense. There are stars that explode that may give off types of energy that are invisible to our eyes. And if we don't view them and study them, then, again, we don't really have the entire picture of what a star explosion might entail.
This is very cool, but I need to think about it, and it makes terrible radio to have me just sitting here doing that. So let's go to the telephone lines. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And Bill, you're part of the connection. Go ahead.
Bill from Brockton?
Yes, indeed, Bill.
This is I, yes. Good morning.
Hi.
I have two questions. One is the parallax to the first parallaxes were measured on fairly dim stars, and I'm curious as to how did they choose those dim stars to find parallax. And the second question is, I thought Captain Cook was involved with something about parallax to the planet Venus, but then I saw a note in a book where Cassini is credited with being the first to measure a solar system parallax. So those are my two questions.
Okay, well, thank you for calling in. If you want to set the phone down, you can listen to Alan on the radio.
Thank you.
Yes, it is true. It's sort of a catch-22 for these early astronomers that to have the best chance to measure this tiny stellar wobble that we call a parallax, you want to focus your attentions, and we're talking about at least a year's worth of focused observations, a year's worth of your professional career. You want to focus those attentions on a fairly nearby star. But if you don't know how far away the stars are, you don't know which are nearby and which are far away. So it is, in fact, the case that the very first star whose distance was measured by Bessel in 1838 is a relatively dim star. It can be seen with the naked eye, but it is certainly nowhere near as bright as, say, Sirius or Alpha Centauri. And what clued Bessel into this particular star, which is known just by the dry name 61 Cygni, is that it moves relatively quickly across the sky, as stars go. And so he figured if this star appears to be moving rapidly across the sky, that would indicate that it's probably fairly close, that if all the stars moved roughly the same way, then if one of them stood out, it's probably because it's fairly close. And that's the reason why he, Bessel, focused on that one star. The other two that were measured shortly after Bessel's, the star Vega is, in fact, one of the brightest stars in the sky, as is the third one, Alpha Centauri. So it was only the first one that was dim. Captain Cook and Cassini, there were many, many attempts to measure the parallaxes of planets and to infer the what we could call the parallax of the sun, how far away the sun was. And yes, Cook and even more Cassini was involved in that measurement. And Cassini is often credited with being the first to measure the distance to the sun.
Is it possible that when we get the first images back from MAP. Now, I had that written out in front of me. Help me out, Lyman. What does MAP stand for? A microwave?
Anisotropy probe.
That the images that this probe sends back will change our understanding of what we've learned by looking at the sky, the sort of thing that Alan is describing. What about that?
Well, the length scales are enormously different. So Alan's talking about measuring parallax to stars in our galaxy. And so our galaxy, he was talking about distances of 10 light years. Our galaxy is something like 100,000 light years across and contains 100 billion stars. You know, it's just about as many stars as Bill Gates has dollars, or used to. And the universe, the observable universe, has 100 billion of those galaxies. And really, what we hope to learn from MAP is how those galaxies themselves formed, and then, and in the process, eventually how stars formed. And so it's the cosmos is huge, and the parallax is the closest scale, and if you will, MAP bounds it at the other end. It's the very largest scale objects you can look at.
In Alan Hirschfeld's book about the search for the parallax, he's looking back, 100 or so years at the quirky nature of the scientists and what drew them into it. 100 years from now, when someone writes about why Lyman Page was part of this MAP probe, what are they going to say? I mean, what draws you to it? What's the big unanswered question or puzzle that you would like to have answered?
Sort of scientifically, it's just how did all the structure in the universe form? That we look up in the sky and we see galaxies and clusters of galaxies, and how did this stuff come to be? And so that's a very specific answer. Just more generally, the cosmos fascinates everyone. And what are its properties? Will the universe expand forever? I mean, these are questions that in this decade, really, we can start to pose as serious scientific questions, and they've been posed as that before, but we can really start to answer them in detailed ways with cross-checks, with multiple measurements. And we're entering an era where the technology has gotten powerful enough that we can really understand the universe at the very largest scales. We're gaining a familiarity, we're shrinking the universe down to so we know it like not quite like our own backyards, but something like that.
I'm trying to understand what's driving this whole thing, and you're getting me halfway there. But I think about this in those moments at night when the lights are out. I'm lying in bed trying to figure out what's out there. You do it. This is your job to do it. So when you go home, and you're sort of nodding off and falling asleep, are you still thinking about it? Is this something that obsesses you?
Yeah. I'd say it's certainly it's so exciting. Not every night, but it's so exciting that when we get a new result in, we'll literally not be able to sleep for days. I mean, we're learning new things about the cosmos at an amazing rate. And just recently, sort of the culmination of a series of measurements, we now are talking confidently that we know the geometry of the universe. We know something about the qualities of space at the largest scales that we can think about.
Qualities of space?
Just what space is like. Is it any different? In Einstein's picture of the universe, it can be curved. Light can follow funny paths. If you will, the universe could be shaped like a horse saddle instead of a flat piece of paper. I know these are they're not everyday concepts, if you will, but the space further away from us, say, could have more galaxies per unit volume than the space nearby us. It's a possibility. And we can directly address that and say, well, how many galaxies are there in a unit volume out there? How does it compare to us? How much extra space is there far away?
Slow down. You're giving me too much to think about.
Yeah, it just occurs to me that both Lyman and I in our work are looking back in time. He's effectively looking through the lens of a telescope, and I'm looking through the lens of history. But in both cases, there's a certain excitement of the hunt, if you will. We are both driven to find out, to answer mysteries.
And John is on the line, driven to find out the answer to another question. John, go ahead.
Yeah, this is all very exciting. And the question I have is really almost a silly question, probably, but here it is. These photons that were created almost immediately after the Big Bang, what have they been doing? They haven't been traveling towards us for the last 15 billion years. Are they reaching us now? What's going on? What have they been doing? What are we measuring? Why aren't they way past where we are? Since they're traveling faster than this planet. Does the question make any sense?
Let's let Lyman in on that.
Sure. I think the way to think of it is we're swimming, sitting on Earth, we're swimming through a gas of photons. That's what it's like being inside a large kiln, a very cold kiln, right? This radiation is just a few degrees above absolute zero. It's the corresponding temperature. But it's no matter where you are in the universe, you see the same radiation. So, yes, we sit here and look out, and we see it is light. This primordial light is coming at us from all directions and is just traversing the universe. And no matter where else in the universe we went, we would see the same thing. And so the light we see, the photons that we get, have truly been traveling the universe unimpeded for 15 billion years.
Just tripping around the universe.
Yeah, no, they do scatter off electrons, as I said, for the first 100,000. But since then, they free stream, if you will, straight towards us.
John, thank you very much for that call, and Lyman for the explanation. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Bring us your questions about the cosmos today. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio.
To infinity and beyond!
I'm Dick Gordon. This is the Star Spangled Connection. Oh. We're talking with the astronomer Alan Hirschfeld and physicist Lyman Page about measuring the universe. And joining us on the phone now is Jane Langton. Jane is a mystery writer who used astronomical themes in two of her books, Dark Nantucket Noon and The Shortest Day. Jane, I understand that you and Alan already have something of a literary connection. Is that accurate?
We traded skills. Alan was writing a mystery story, and he needed a critical reader, and I needed help from an astronomer on the one that I was writing, and it was a kind of tit-for-tat, which is very nice.
Now, you've been listening in on the conversation.
Yes.
And the callers and Lyman Page's explanation of what's ahead, and you know about Alan's book about what's behind us. I'm curious to know if, in your mind, we need to leaven the intensity of science with a more literate approach.
Oh, the wonderful thing about Alan's book, Parallax, is that he tells stories. He shares his own excitement and tells one story after another, so it's delectable to read. I particularly love his epigraphs, which are well-chosen sentences at the beginnings of chapters that illuminate the subject of the chapters. They're from famous people like Mark Twain, William Blake, Shakespeare. I'd love to read to you the one about Huckleberry Finn. He's on his raft in the Mississippi. We had the sky up there all speckled with stars, and we used to lay on our backs and look up at them and discuss about whether they was made or only just happened. How could there be a more fundamental question than that?
And it is, so what you're saying is it is, in fact, the writer's brain, the literate brain, that gives us a better access to some of this than we might otherwise get.
Yes, it's not difficult. It's delightful, and it's full of pictures. and full of chapter headings like The Turbulent Lens, Crossed Eyes and Wobbling Stars, A Coal Cellar with a View, The Dismal Swamp. It's for the layperson, and I found it delightful reading.
Lyman, when you're trying to explain things like the MAP project to lay people like me, do you need to search out these sorts of connections that Jane's talking about?
Yes, I think it's difficult on the radio because it seems like I guess I tend to be more visual.
And this is the most visual medium that exists. We're in the theater of the imagination here. You give us anything, we'll create the picture.
Yes, no, these analogies are everything in this, in explaining. Just because it's the only way we can understand it. The distances and time scales are so vast, no one has any day-to-day experience with them. And when I think of galaxies, I think of frisbees or dinner plates and millions of them flying around me, right? That's
Well, I'm glad you do that. I do, too.
In my own teaching, and I've taught literally thousands of college students over 23 years, many of them comment that they feel so small and insignificant compared to the size of the universe. And I guess in an attempt to comfort them, I point out that, although physically that might be the case, that we somehow have the capacity to enclose within our imagination a good portion of the universe, if not all of it. And that I think is a remarkable testimony to humans, to human abilities and imagination.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Jane Lyman, thank you very much for bringing that literary note to the conversation. Priscilla's joining us on the line. Hi, Priscilla.
Yes, this is Priscilla Kelso from Newton, Massachusetts. Like Jane Lyman, I, too, am a student and a teacher of poetry. And I would like to add a similar dimension about the fact that when we talk about primordial light trillions of miles away, it reminds me of when I was a little child in Asia looking up at the Milky Way without electricity and beginning to understand a little bit of the hunger of the spirit for connections beyond the earth. And that is poetry. And also, for us in the 21st century to begin to understand that there is such a thing as creatureliness and humility and even a spiritual dimension to the search for factual knowledge about the cosmos. I am very enamored of Robert Frost's lines in Choose Something Like a Star when he says, "And when at times the mob is swayed to carry praise or blame too far, we may choose something like a star to stay our minds on and be stayed." And that was long before this NASA explorer is going to tell us a lot of news about what's happening out there. But even the word primordial light has resonance of a deeper need for connection for people who are aware of the fact that we are just all passing through and the universe will be here for a long, long time.
I couldn't agree with you more. I get absolutely swept away by the language of black holes and wormholes and dark matter. Priscilla, thank you for that. You know, when you read the newspaper, you have to wait for the next day's correction. I can do it right now. The writer Jane Langton was with us a couple of minutes ago. She's written Dark Nantucket Noon and The Shortest Day. 1-800-423-8255 is the number for The Connection, 1-800-423-TALK. And Richard is joining us on the line. Hi, Richard.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well.
When you were speaking earlier, before we got into a lot of the literary analogies, you mentioned that there's a lot of support for the idea that the universe or the known universe began with a Big Bang. You also mentioned that it's still something of a question whether it may expand forever or not. But one thing that I haven't been able to find any data or theories about is where would the Big Bang have come from? Or where would the stuff that exploded come from? And I'm curious if there's any data or theory or information about that.
Lyman Page, would you like to give us a layman's answer to that?
Sure. The Big Bang, it happened everywhere. This notion that it's since it is the 4th of July, that it's a firecracker going off, it's a quick one, but that's not it. The universe has been infinite, and it's as though everything were packed down much, much, much more tightly together. When things are packed that tightly, it's a different form. The stuff of which we're made wasn't in the form of the stuff of which we're made. I mean, there weren't protons and electrons.
Right.
It was a completely different forms of energy. And I think it compressed down to the point where no one is sure what that primordial stuff was. It was some sort of field, if you will, some type of substance which people are still groping with. We don't know. We know that when this event happened, when it started to expand, and I think why it started to expand there's no consensus there, but we know that it certainly did because we're here. The stuff of which we're made and lots of other forms of matter about which we're just gaining a picture now, right? We don't know what 95% of the universe is made of.
Right.
And that stuff, the space, if you will, expanded and took that out, and then, if you will, we condensed out of that.
Right. No, your answer makes sense, particularly when I think of it in the sense that if it was stuff that isn't around anymore, then how could there be data that would explain what it was? How could we know what it was or how it got there if that ain't what's around anymore?
Yes, there are remnants of it. So if we take the stuff that we know about and all of our physical theories, we can, the protons, the atoms of which we're made, particularly the protons, extrapolate back to the first 3 minutes. We can go a little bit beyond there, or roughly about that time, and talk about neutrinos, another type of subatomic particle. We see all these. It then takes a physical model to extrapolate back further. And the model that will ultimately be the most believed, I think, is the model that can tie all the different forms of matter we now see together. It will be some unifying model for all the matter in the universe, right? All the different types we now see. But you're right, the first stuff isn't around anymore, right? It's transformed into something new.
Yeah, I have a comment that doesn't really pertain to this caller's question, but the previous caller's observation that we are in some danger of losing our legacy of the night sky. There are many, many people nowadays, many of my students, for example, who have never really seen the true night sky. And that's because of the light pollution, as astronomers call it, that is so rampant in our country and other parts of the world. So for anyone who is a city dweller or suburban dweller, I recommend that you really do, at some point, preferably soon, find a dark location away from the city, out of the suburbs, and just enjoy the true view of the night sky. Then maybe you'll think poetically also.
This is exactly what your probe is doing, isn't it, Lyman? Like, you're a million miles away, so you can get an unpolluted look at what it is you want to look at.
That's right. No, that's exactly right. But at least I wouldn't call it pollution, most of the stuff we're trying to get away from was here before all this, the more recent pollution from, if you will, from city lights, etc.
When do you expect to get data, images back from the probe that will start to make some sense.
It takes 3 months to travel out to this place called the second Lagrange point. And it'll be about a year and a half after that before we have the first images of the whole sky. So it will be another 18 or so months from now before we have the picture. And then we'll, of course, check it over the following year.
And what do you do in the time in between when you're waiting?
This is sort of a different form of astronomy than I think people are getting more accustomed to it. There's a lot of data analysis involved and a lot of checks to make sure that things like the sun aren't corrupting your answer, or to make sure that you're really looking at this primordial light and you're not looking at light, say, from distant galaxies or from some faint objects in our own galaxy. So most of the effort will go into, you know, ensuring that this picture that we end up presenting is truly a picture of the oldest light.
It sounds in a way like you did actually steal a lot from the astronomers chronicled in Alan's book in terms of how they moved aside all the imperfections and the distractions to get to the pure answer you're looking for.
Yes, no, it's very much like that. I mean, I think it happens throughout science. It takes a lot of work to get these final pictures and that we need to make progress.
Lyman, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And to Alan Hirschfeld, thank you for coming into the studio.
Thank you, Dick.
Especially on this holiday. Alan Hirschfeld is astronomer at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth and author of Parallax, The Race to Measure the Cosmos. Lyman Page is a professor of physics at Princeton University. He's also working on NASA's MAP project. We were joined earlier by Jane Langton, author of mystery novels, including Dark Nantucket Moon and The Shortest Day. Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation on our website at theconnection.org. We had help today from Tim Monroe, Darren Manoogian, and Kim Bichari. The Connection is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Ben Walker. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This is W.